The United Church of God presents Don Pierwitz with a sermon titled, God's Rescue Plan. It was recorded October 18, 2011 in Branson, Missouri.
I hope you're all having a wonderful feast, and I know everybody I've seen has been having a wonderful feast, and I know we've had relatively few anointings, so I guess everybody's in fairly good health. I want to go back a couple of decades, I think it was. I don't remember the exact year, but many of you who were around back then remember hearing the news stories about Uganda and Entebbe and a group of terrorists who hijacked a plane to Uganda and stayed there with the blessing of the madman dictator for life, Idi Amin. It was later made into a movie for TV, but it was an amazing rescue story. And the rescues make pretty interesting stories, particularly the one as successful as this, at least for the Israelis. They sent in a commando force to rescue the hostages, who were Israelis, basically, and did so very suddenly, very professionally, with a great deal of planning. Well, that they had a short time to plan, but it was very thorough. And were able to rescue all but one of the hostages. I think one woman had been taken to a hospital where she was never heard from again. And one of the commandos died in the raid. All of the terrorists, I believe, were killed, as were a number of troops from Uganda. So it was an amazing story of rescue. And these things kind of, I don't know, they get our attention. I know when it was happening in the news, I don't think my kids paid much attention to it, but when they made a movie about it. And the movie was really exciting and really exciting to watch. But we are here today and this week to celebrate a rescue. You know, the rescue that Jesus Christ is going to make and God the Father of this entire earth, and of course we personally as well, and as well as everyone around us eventually. Of course, I'll start by asking a question because, let me tell you a little about myself. I'm doing very well. I'm retired. I get Social Security, I have an IRA, I have a nice home, not lavish, but a nice, adequate home, and a gorgeous wife. She told me not to say that. But, and healthy children, and I've got three cars now. I mean, I was a one-car family for decades. We're trying to sell one of them. If any of you want to buy a Saturn, I'll see you after services. But for me, life is good. And I think for most of you, life is good. We live in the most prosperous society in the world. Of course, there's a question as to how stable that is, but we're fed regularly, as you can see I am. And we have all of our immediate needs taken care of, I think. Life is good. My question today would be, rescue from what? You know, I like my house. I didn't plant a garden this year, but I plan to next year, and like I say, I'm fairly contented, and I would ask, a rescue from what? And I think you might ask the same question, because most of you seem to be content and happy with what you have and where you live and your circumstance in life. And I'll begin by saying we need to be rescued from this world, because this world is at odds with God's way of life. And we come in contact with that every once in a while. We become aware of that every once in a while, how opposed to God's way of life that this world in general is. Turn to John 15 and verse 18. John 15 and verse 18, and Jesus Christ warned us. He said, if the world hate you, you should know that it hated me before it hated you. For if you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of this world, but I have chosen you out of this world, therefore the world hates you. Doesn't that make you feel great? I just love to be hated? No, I want people to like me. But sometimes they think I'm a little bit weird. You know, people I've worked with over the decades that knew I had to be gone on Friday night and wouldn't be back till at the earliest Saturday night. And I remember one time I was at a convention in Nashville with the company I was with, and Friday night came along, and I went to my hotel room, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to eat supper sometime, so I'll go out and have supper. And I was walking down the halls of this hotel and came upon my boss, and he looked at me, was startled. He said, I thought you hibernated on Friday night. Well, I had to eat sometime. But we can look around us in this world, and we can see the troubled world we live in. I don't think I have to stress that. You know, we see people with marriage and social problems. It's always awkward for me when I see someone. Well, there are two questions I hate to ask, but if I haven't seen anybody in a while, it's usually is, at my age, is so-and-so still living? Or is so-and-so still married to so-and-so? Because so often you give somebody 10 years, things like that change. Well, they die, which is natural and normal, but marriage is so unstable anymore that you kind of have to ask. Or even, are you still married to so-and-so? Because we have marriage problems in our society. We have social problems that we hear about. Somebody was saying yesterday how difficult it must be for teenagers today with all the temptations and all the problems they have. We have a teenager in our family. He's our grandson, and we always worry about, you know, what's he going to be led into? So we have those problems. We have economic woes. We have a big, protest movement going on these days, the Occupy Wall Street thing. And I have a few feelings about that I guess I won't share with you. But it just seems like, at first it was not, it didn't seem very well focused. And I was listening to a commentary by Governor Huckabee, former Governor Huckabee from Arkansas, who also does a radio commentary. And he said he'd figured it out because of their actions in New York City, where a lot of them were using the restrooms in McDonald's and all these other places, usually leaving them a mess and not buying anything. He says that explains it. They want something for nothing. And again, there are probably some legitimate claims that they have and some legitimate concerns that they have, but sometimes you wonder. We see wars. We see violence all around us. In needing to be rescued, I was thinking of, when I left my little house earlier this week, or was it last week? Now, last week, to come down here, you know, I locked the door. And we have a neighbor coming over, and she comes over every morning and turns the outside lights off. And my daughter, who works in the neighborhood, comes by and turns them on in the evening. So it'll look like we're still there. Because we don't live in a safe society. We have to lock our doors. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to do that? Although one day I was walking through my neighborhood, it was on the Sabbath morning, and I just happened to walk by a school, and was thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if this were God's kingdom? People would probably maybe be gathering at the school for Sabbath services or whatever. And it was a quiet time. And I noticed something very unusual. It made me feel good. But I noticed at the school there was a bike rack, and there was a bike in there. And it was a fairly new bike, I think. And it wasn't locked. Nobody had stolen it. And I thought, that's pretty unusual. And that makes me feel good that that had not happened, because we kind of expect that. We live in a society where we do have a lot of crime and a lot of violence, a lot of social unrest, a lot of economic uncertainty. But we need to look at things and see, well, to begin with, in considering our rescue, where are we now? Where are we now? Turn to Matthew 24. The Olivet Prophecy, sort of a focal point of prophecy, Matthew 24. Beginning in verse 6. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled. All these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. You know, we see wars. We've lived through wars. Some of you have probably participated in wars, you know, been drafted and things like that. Nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places. These are all the beginnings of sorrow. You know, we see these things around us now. They're just the beginning of sorrows. And there are some horrible things that have happened. But I was at a small restaurant in North Springfield a few months ago, and, well, it was a McDonald's. All right, I didn't want you to think it was too fancy. But there was a guy at the next booth who, there are some Bible colleges in that area as well. And he was explaining to a woman there that, you know, gas was about to go over $3 a gallon. When gas goes over $3 a gallon, that's a certain sign that Jesus Christ's return is imminent. Well, that was over a year ago, I guess. I'm trying to think when gas went over $3 a gallon. I have a friend that said, well, till it goes back down under $3 a gallon, I'm not going to buy gas. Well, he had to give that up. But we see these things, and they trouble us, of course, in our own area. We saw the Joplin tornado. That was pretty chilling. I mean, that was pretty... I used to go to Joplin because we used to have a congregation over there, so I've driven all over the city at one time or another. I have not been back since the tornado. I've driven by it, but just watching it on television, it's heartbreaking. You know, these real normal neighborhoods are just rubble. And 100, last count, 162 people died in that tornado on that Sunday afternoon, May 22nd. Everybody around here remembers that. But, and I know some people were saying, well, that's it. You know, when things like that happen, that's the end of the age. Well, we need to take a look at history. And we need to look back and see, I mean, I'm not trying to downplay the Joplin tornado. It was a horrible thing. And I guess, again, if you were there, you would know that more than I do because I was 70 miles away. But we see these things happening around us. And, of course, we can see other things. We can look at the situation in Africa, in East Africa, and why can't I think of the Somalia, and the starving refugees, 400,000 in one camp that they were talking about on the news last night. 400,000 people on the verge of starvation. They don't even have water. You know, when you take a drink of water, you kind of take that for granted. You go to a restaurant, they usually bring you water because it's plentiful here. I feel a little guilty sometimes when I'm filling my coffee pot and I put it under the spigot and let it run and turn around and do something else and notice that it's overflowing and I'm wasting water. But we take it so much for granted here. But the problems that we're looking forward to will be unprecedented, worse than anything we've seen before. Turn to Daniel 12 in verse 1. Daniel 12 in verse 1. Daniel 12, verse 1. And at that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince, which stands for the children of thy people. There shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to the same time, and that thy people shall be delivered, every one that's found written in the book. But the point I'm making here is, this will be a time of trouble like we have never seen before as human beings. Turn to Matthew 24 again. Matthew 24 and verse 21. For then shall be great tribulation, such as has not been seen since the beginning of the world, nor to this time, nor shall ever be. Before Christ rescues us, rescues our neighbors, rescues this world, we're going to see things happen that are unprecedented. Now you look back in history. I'm a big fan of the History Channel, and I like reading about history sometimes, but some of history, of course, is very unpleasant. You look at Joplin, you look at maybe the population of Missouri and what portion of the population died in that tornado. you know, relatively speaking, I mean, if you're the family of a dead person that died in that tornado, that's a big, you know, that's a big deal and should be. But you look at that and what a small percentage of Missouri that was, what a small percentage of this nation died in that tornado or in any one storm event. And you look back in history and look at the plague, the bubonic plague in the 14th century, where Europe lost about, I've read various figures ranging from 30 to 60% of its population in 5 years. About half. About half the people that lived in Europe during the bubonic plague died. And it was a horrible death. It's going to be worse than that in the future. But, you know, think of that. Think of your neighbors. Look around your neighborhood. Pick out 20 neighbors and figure, what if 10 of them died from this disease in the next few years? That would get your attention. You look at the plague in history. You look at the Inquisitions back during the Middle Ages when the Catholic Church, you know, and some of its practitioners, some of its clergy went out and got rid of people who were heretics. Probably people like us, you know, people who kept the Sabbath, many of them, people who read the Bible directly. And, of course, it was an effort to squelch the Bible, to, you know, keep people from being able to read the Bible by themselves and on their own. So we might have fallen victim to that. We had a leadership club a couple of years ago, well, up until recently, up until around the first of the year. And I remember one man had table topics, I guess we still called him that, and said, well, wouldn't you love to live in a Christian nation instead of the type of nation we live in now where people turn their backs on God? Wouldn't you love to live in a Christian nation? Well, I didn't want to, you know, rain on his parade, but I thought, you know, the way man handles that, no. I don't want to live in a Christian nation that man sets up, because all of us here would be in deep trouble because we wouldn't fit the mold of what Christianity should be. And when people in power have that prerogative of, you know, determining what's right and what's wrong aside from God's word, you end up with inquisitions. You know, you end up with people who are what happened back then. You know, you can read, if you have the stomach for it, you can read Fox's Book of Martyrs and how some of the ways people were killed and tortured because in some cases they were Christians, but they didn't quite fit the government policy at that time. We can look at brutal conquerors who swept across from Asia into I guess what is now Eastern Europe and of course across Asia. People like Genghis Khan, and then going in the other direction, Alexander the Great. And in some cases, I think Alexander was rather benevolent because he was trying to recruit people for his army. Others, though, you can see raged across from the steppes of Asia and killed whole communities. And, oh, how about those crusaders that went to the Middle East and went in and killed whole Jewish communities on their way in there? Oh, these were Christians. You know, I'm a little amazed sometimes at how we tend to condemn Muslims as terrorists when you look at some of the terrorist acts that people have committed in the name of Christ, or attempted to or desired to. There was a little group down here in Arkansas that I think they call themselves the cross and the sword and the armor of God or something like that. But they had a compound down there that was full of all kinds of armaments. And it came to light after a guest there from some other such group was driving up Highway 65 here, was pulled over by police and had a number of weapons in his van, opened fire, killed one Missouri State Trooper and wounded another. And all of a sudden, in fact, I think I was in Branson on that day, and all of a sudden there were helicopters all over the place looking for this guy. But we have those type of things. We have in our own lifetime Holocausts. The Holocaust. Some of you remember that maybe from your, some of you are older than me. A few of you are. I was at the 60-plus luncheon. I know you're here. But, you know, that was a horrible thing. 6 million Jews butchered killed in Germany. Can you remember, or Europe, can you imagine being one of those? Just think of one of those people, what that must have been like to be taken off and to have no rescue, no way out. Now, I know there are conspiracy theorists who say that, well, that never happened. I won't embarrass this guy by mentioning his name, but there's a gentleman in the Springfield congregation who was there as a liberator at the end of World War II. Talk to him about it, because he saw it firsthand. But we see all these things, and as bad as they were, as bad as things are around us today, we are going to see a time unprecedented in world history for horror and for, you know, things that are just horrifying to even think about. I want you to do something right now. I don't know, the lady who taught the seminar is here, so she can correct me later if I'm wrong. And it was dealing with anger. One of the techniques I remembered was, and I hope I have my numbers right, take a deep breath and wait 6 seconds. So we'll all do that now. Take a deep breath. Relax. And while you're doing that, turn to Isaiah 11. And as Paul Harvey would say, we'll hear the rest of the story. Isaiah 11. You've read this before. This is something we read over and over again during the Feast of Tabernacles, I think, from time to time, or the Spring Holy Days. And this is at the end of the part about where do all the animals go? Okay, we have the animals up here, and where we talk about animals and prophecy, and Isaiah talks about animals being friendly, children being able to play with them and reach down into a snake's den and not getting fatally bit, as would happen today. But Isaiah 11, beginning in verse 9, in fact, I don't even need to read this whole chapter to get excited about it, or this whole verse. The first part says, they shall not hurt nor destroy in my holy mountain. And here's a half a verse that just thrills me to death each time I read it, and particularly this time of the year. And the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Look around at our corrupt world. Yes. Step back, take that deep breath. Wait a few seconds and ponder this. It should give you a great deal of comfort as we look at that world to come, that rescue that we're going to enjoy. Can you imagine the whole world in harmony with God? And again, as I thought walking through my neighborhood on the Sabbath morning, and there was very little traffic or anything, I thought, well, this is what it's going to be like in the kingdom. Of course, I forgot what happened next. I mean, a garbage truck went by or something, and all right, I'm back to reality again. I don't observe Christmas, but I really enjoy Christmas when it comes on the Sabbath. Tell you why. Because I'm hurrying home from work, and I look around, and all the stores and shops and restaurants are closing down. I have an imagination. My wife tells me sometimes that I wear rose-colored glasses. But I think, oh, wouldn't it be nice if it was not because it was Christmas, if they were doing this because it was the Sabbath. And then over a week later, if New Year's falls on the Sabbath, I can go out on New Year's morning, and it's quiet. Because everybody's dead drunk. No, not everybody, because I know a lot of people who observe that and would not. My in-laws were Jehovah's Witnesses, and I think one year we went up there around Christmas time. We missed it, but I thought, what a great family to spend Christmas with, because they don't keep Christmas either. But imagine the world being at harmony with God. Think of that in terms of your neighborhood, the place where you work, you know, or go to school, God's Word being taught in the schools, authoritatively and for real, and not tainted by, you know, the type of things that happened down through history in those, quote, Christian nations. So we're going to see that. We're going to see rescue. We are going to be rescued. More importantly, the entire world eventually is going to be rescued. Those people in Somalia who are starving to death, they may yet starve to death, but at some point they'll be resurrected and they will be rescued. Well, another heartsick thing that bothers me is the situation in the Congo. I don't know what's going on there now, but over the past few years, there have been troops in there. You know, government troops, rebel troops, I don't know which side, who just, it's part of their strategy or their tactics, they rape women. You know, and these women over there are left pregnant with children that were, brought about by some soldier who came through and took what he wanted, basically. And those people are going to be rescued. Right now, there's no rescue for them sometimes, because sometimes it's the government that sponsors that sort of thing in some of these countries. But it's horrible. But we look, and again, we can step back, take that deep breath, and take courage in looking at Isaiah 11 and just the second half of verse 9. And there are other scriptures through the other verses and chapters in the Bible that can give us that comfort. Another, I guess I shouldn't say thing, but another element that we are going to be rescued from, we're going to be rescued from Satan. And Satan does have an effect on us. Satan holds sway over today's world. Ephesians 2 and verse 2. Ephesians 2:2. Where in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. That's Satan, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. You know, this whole world is under the sway of Satan. And you don't have to go far to see it, to see his influence. And turning to Revelation 13 and verse 4. Revelation 13 and verse 4. And worshipped the dragon, and gave power unto the beast, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth that speaks great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 40 and 2 months. I'm in the wrong place. No, I'm not. I'm in the right place. I'll continue on. But anyway, that Satan is, you know, the prince of the power of the air. He holds sway over this world, you know, and he is our enemy, very personally our enemy. He's out to get us, and he's out to get a lot of people. But turn to 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Boy, we've heard this verse a lot. 1 Peter 5, 8. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, that's your enemy, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. You got to give him permission, give him opportunity to devour you. But he does. He's our enemy. He wants to kill us. He wants to destroy us. And, you know, he's out there all the time poking at us. And he's up there with God saying, hey, did you see so-and-so? Maybe he uses your name. I'm sure at some point he does. You know, did you see Mitch Knapp? I'm not picking on him, by the way. I can see him from here. But, you know, if he does something wrong, which, you know, I know better than that, he never does anything wrong. But Satan's up there saying, did you see what he did? Or more likely, do you know what he's thinking about right now? You know, or, you know, and I can mention other names. Again, he's unfortunate enough to be sitting where I can see him. But Satan's up there doing that. He's out to get us. He's particularly targeting us. But it says whom he may. So it's up to us, you know, to give in to him or not. But he's still an influence. He's still poking at us. He's still saying, congregation in Springfield knows how I feel about road rage. I'm in favor of it. My wife can tell you that too. I mean, I was out here on Highway 65 one time. I was going to Harrison, and there was a person in front of me on Highway 65 going 30 miles an hour. My wife hates to hear me say this, too. I think they were on drugs. And they were topping the hill at Hollister. But I'm sure they were interested in safety. That's why they were going slow, and that's why this person just sailed through the red light ahead of them. Fortunately, nobody was there to collide with them. Okay, so that's, now you know one of my faults. One of the things I think about, and every once in a while I bite my tongue, mentally, and sometimes physically, and say, you know, I shouldn't be thinking like this. Or, you know, you walk around the mall, and you see, well, boy, there's a real beauty. Well, usually it's a man that I, you know, I mean, but, you know, you think badly about people sometimes. It makes you feel better, of course, about yourself. But I wonder if Jesus Christ were walking through the mall, what would he see? That person that I might see and tend to condemn, because I'm so much better than they are, at least kid myself into thinking that, Jesus Christ would see potential. And I've tried to do that. You know, if I see somebody that I tend not to like just because they don't look like somebody I would tend to like, I try to look and say, now this person is probably, his hands are probably filthy because maybe he's good at working with cars. Maybe he's the guy I would like to run into if my car broke down on the highway, or the guy I'd like to see at the service station, or the guy I'd call out, you know, if my air conditioner went out in the middle of the summer or the furnace went out in the winter. They may not be particularly pretty people, but they've got something, and they may be very hardworking people, and I don't see that. Jesus Christ would see that. Jesus Christ would see their potential. So, you know, how did I get off on this? I don't know. Oh, the way Satan pokes at us. And Satan's up there accusing everybody, and he may be accusing people to us. You know, or that good-looking woman on the billboard there. Did you ever see a billboard that was trying to get your attention with a good-looking woman? They're all over the place, you know. And there are a lot of things like that that Satan uses to get us. In this case, the advertising community, oh, I'm a part of that, is trying to get us to buy something with it. But they're using sex to do that. The good news about Satan, again, let's take a deep breath. Let's wait a few seconds. Let's turn to Revelation 20 in verse 1. We've been there before, I think. You probably read this on the Day of Atonement. And I saw an angel come down from heaven. This is Revelation 20, verse 1, having the keys of a bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on that dragon, the old serpent, the devil, and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. And cast him to the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more. He's going to lose his power till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and then he'll be loosed for a little time, or a little season, it says here. So Satan is going to be chained. Satan is going to be restrained. I mean, sometimes we like to blame everything on Satan, and I don't know if that's appropriate. I remember driving back in the early days of the church to Toronto with somebody, and there's a big bridge. If you've been to Hamilton, Ontario, they've probably got another new bridge by now. This was 40 years ago. And he said, oh, yeah, that's where so-and-so was driving when Satan struck and one of his tires blew out. Of course, he was probably driving around on bald tires. But still, we tend to blame Satan for a lot of things that we ourselves are responsible for, a lot of the thoughts that we may harbor. But Satan is back there poking at us, and he's there at God's throne accusing us, saying, you know, did you see that? Did you, you know, look at what so-and-so's doing. So we have to be rescued from Satan. That's going to happen. Satan is going to be changed. There's somebody else we're going to need to be rescued from. It's an individual in your life. You're going to have to be rescued from yourself. I'm going to have to be rescued from myself. Jeremiah 17. Jeremiah 17. See how sterling and wonderful we human beings are. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. And again, another familiar scriptures. I don't come up with a lot of new truth here. This is stuff we've heard for years. We just need to be reminded of from time to time. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. The heart. Whose heart? Let's take that personally. Your heart. My heart. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? You know, when we get really, and you know, I mean, you know what you're really like. I know what I'm really like. You get deep down inside. And, you know, we can be pretty wicked. Hopefully we're overcoming a lot of that. Hopefully we're becoming better every year as we examine ourselves around Passover time, and hopefully every day. But our hearts are naturally, deceitfully wicked. And we need to control that. We need to be rescued from that. And again, that rescue may be happening now in part, but it'll be happening for sure when Jesus Christ returns, when we're turned into spirit. Psalm 62 and verse 9. Psalm 62 and verse 9. Surely men of low degree are vanity. You know, and you know, some people are of low degree, let's say, and they're proud of their poverty. They're proud of their humility. They're proud they never got beyond fifth grade or whatever. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with being poor or being uneducated, if that happens to have happened to you. But some people take a great deal of pride in it. And men of high degree are a lie. Really? Well, you've seen National Enquirer. They love to pick on those people who are... And some of that stuff turns out to be true. That's the disturbing part about it. But we find out all these dirty little secrets about people we thought were so good and so pure. All I have to say is Tiger Woods. And hopefully he's getting his act together. But, you know, when that came out, we found out. Of course, at first, my first reaction is always, oh, come on, it's just National Enquirer. But inquiring minds want to know. Men of low degree are a lie. There's a lot of phoniness to be laid in the balance and altogether lighter than vanity. I mean, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, whatever, you know, there's a lot of vanity in our lives. And my wife will tell you I'm a pretty good example of it sometimes. But we really need to be working on that. And we really need to be overcoming that. And we need to be rescued from that nature, from our own nature sometimes. Look at the Apostle Paul. Now, here's a man that God used mightily in Scripture. And turn to Romans 7. Romans 7. Beginning at verse 14. For we know that the law is good and spiritual. We know that the law is spiritual, and I am carnal, sold under sin. For that which I allow not, for what I would, that I do. And that what I hate, whatever it is I hate, you know, I do that. Sometimes I had an aunt who was rather wise, at least I thought she was. I remember her saying one time that, she'd read somewhere that the things that we hate the most in other people are the things that we're most guilty of sometimes. You know, I thought I was the champion of road rage, although I've never acted on it. But, and if then I do that which I would not, I consent under the law that it is good. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing, for to will is present in me, but how to perform that which is good I find not. It's kind of hard to read because it's so confusing. And we are so confused inside, and we can apply that to our own case. For the good that I would do, or that I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now, if I do that which I would not, It is no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find there a law that's present, that I would do good. You know, when I'm going to do good, evil is present with me. I delight in the law of God after the inward man, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. Oh, wretched man that I am. Have you ever come to that point when you look at yourself and say, oh, what a wretched man or woman that I am? We come face to face with ourselves and we don't like what we see. Who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord, so that with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. We're really, and that's confusing to me, but we are confused people. You know, I mean, we look at ourselves and we really sometimes don't know right from wrong. You know, our feelings, and then our thoughts. I had a experience with Yakov Smirnov one time. I had it was a good experience. He's just got his degree in an advanced degree in psychology, and he was doing a little seminar. And I was on the radio, and I wanted to do a radio interview with him. And his assistant said, "Well, come to the seminar, and after the seminar, you know, you can interview him." I said, "Okay," and it was a convenient location for me. And he invited me, well, he didn't, but his assistant, who had never seen me, didn't know who I was or what I was there for, said, here, fill this out. So we had to fill this thing out, and I had to participate. I wanted to participate, see what it was all about. My wife wasn't with me. I mean, it was just a, sort of a business thing. Others were basically couples, and found out it was a marriage-type seminar, and then he took these comment cards. Let's see what, and he read mine right off the bat. He says, "Let's get this guy up here and see what he's all about." And I said, "Well, my wife's not with me." He said, "Well, I'll be your wife." And so we had little uniforms. I had a little cap with a brain on it, and he had a little necklace with a heart. And what we had found, we had done a little role playing here. Or actually, there was a quiz, and everybody who answered these questions go to this side of the room this way, and everybody who answered the questions this other way go to the other side of the room. And all the men went to one side of the room, all the women went to another. And I would tell him, "Well, here's what I think. What do you think?" And he'd say, "Well, I feel that." And we found out, or his lesson in this was, that men think, women feel. So when you're talking, guys, this may work. Don't ask your wife what she thinks. Tell her what you think. Ask her what she feels. As women feel. And that's a lot more profound, and that's a wonderful thing. Men are sometimes just too analytical. Now, there are some analytical women, but how did I get off on that? Anyway, we have these internal conflicts where sometimes we go with what we feel, and it really isn't the right thing. I'm not picking on the women, because sometimes men do what they think is right, and it ain't. But this whole section in Romans 7, it can be confusing. And we are confused. We need to be rescued from that. Another step back. Take a deep breath. I hope it's 6 seconds. Turn to Psalm 119. This is the longest chapter in the Bible. I'm not going to read all of it. But I go to it for comfort from time to time and for direction. And we'll begin with verse 1. Again, I promise not to read the whole thing, but just certain passages here that in our conflicted state, that we can read this and take comfort in it and direction from it. Blessed are the undefiled in the way who walk in the law of the Lord. Blessed are they that keep his testimonies. You know, we're blessed. We're happy. God's law is a way to happiness, and that seek him with the whole heart. I don't know if he turned there, but Mr. Cagle mentioned seeking first the kingdom of heaven. You know, do we do that? Do we seek God's kingdom with our whole heart? Skipping down to verse 10, with my whole heart have I sought thee. Oh, let me not wander from your commandments. You want to be unconflicted? Learn to apply God's law to your life. At verse 18, open my eyes that I may behold wondrous things out of your law. You know, when we study the law and realize how beneficial it is, you know, even just starting, of course, with the basic Ten Commandments. And I think the question has been asked, what if everybody kept the Ten Commandments? I wouldn't have had to lock my doors when I left the house. I wouldn't have had my daughter sneaking in there in the evening and turning on the outside lights and turning on different lights in different rooms so it looks like somebody's home, you know, because people wouldn't steal. Of course, we would be safe because people wouldn't, or secure. Oh, it's, we had a little discussion before the feast about whether it was security or safety. It's safety. Somehow security brings up legal problems when we use that term. So if you see Mr. Stolle, he's in charge of safety. Okay, and I feel safe. He's doing a good job. Nobody's thrown ripe fruit at me yet, or rotten fruit. Skipping down to verse 45. Verse 45, and I will walk at liberty, for I seek your precepts. You want real freedom? You know, look to God's law for real freedom. And verse 90, so I promised I wouldn't read the whole thing, but verse 90 of Psalm 119, thy faithfulness is to all generations. Thou hast established the earth, and it abides. God's law, God's principles are consistent. They're not going to change with the times. And I remember seeing, I think driving through Shreveport or down in that area one time, and it'll give away when it was, but there was a big billboard some church had put up, and it's, what is right for the 90s? You remember the 90s, all right. But, and I think the church probably was saying what I'm going to say, that what was right for the 70s and the 60s and the 50s is right for the year 2011. God's law is established. It's consistent. It doesn't change. Well, people will tell you it changed. You know, this harsh father, you know, ruled before Jesus Christ came and changed everything, made everything easier for us. Well, we know on many levels that that isn't true. Verse 124. Deal with thy servant according to thy mercy. Teach me thy statutes. Do we seek to be taught? Do we go through God's law and God's word every day, seeking to learn and seeking to be a little bit different? I remember when I told this to the congregation in Springfield, when I first came into the church back in 1964, 65, I would go to church each week, and I would say to myself, what am I going to learn this week that I'm not going to like? Because I was learning so many new things. Although I'd gotten, this young minister came to see me on a baptizing tour. I don't even think it was an ordained minister yet. Back in when I lived in Boston in 1962, his name was Dennis Luker. And I thought I was just going to go get baptized. Well, he explained to me over an entire afternoon how the church would change my lifestyle if I was serious. You know, I was in the Army at the time. He says, of course, I can't keep the Sabbath. Got to work Friday night, Saturday. He says, if you're serious about this, you will keep the Sabbath to the point of death. Whoa! And there were other things, but I would go with that attitude. But are we of the attitude now, God, show me what you want, and I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to change my life, and we find ourselves. Hopefully next year at the feast, you'll be different than you are today. Maybe not radically different, but you'll be a little more on course for God's kingdom. Another scripture that I take great comfort in is Psalm 119, verse 165. Great peace have they which love thy law. King James English. When we love God's law, we can have peace. And it says here, and nothing shall offend them. Or if you read that a little, you know, the other translations, so cause them to stumble. Want to stay out of trouble? Love God's law. Obey God's law. Make it a part of your life. But I'm Kind of preaching to the choir here, aren't I? Y'all believe that anyway. Like I said, I don't have any new truth here today. I'm sorry. But, brethren, we live in a corrupt and dangerous world. And it's getting worse. It's going to get a lot worse. It's a world under the influence of Satan. And it affects every one of us and every human being. We need to be rescued. I remember when I was a kid, my mother said, well, you boys ought to pray. And what do we pray? Well, we'd go to the Lord's Prayer. Good place to start. And my brother and I, since we thought that was kind of boring, we would read through it at record speeds. Just going through it and, and with not very much respect. But there's three words in there that will tell us why we're here today, what our prayer should be. And it's in Matthew 6 and verse 10. Matthew 6 and verse 10. You probably don't even need it. You're maybe like my brother and I. Maybe you memorized it. But Matthew 6 and verse 10. Pretty simple. The first three words there. This is what we are celebrating, what we are imploring God to do. Thy kingdom come. That's the purpose of the feast in three words. That's why we're here. That's what we're celebrating. Thy kingdom come. We need to be rescued.